Well, it's amazing what the mind can do, isn't it? Our guest, Dr. Joe Dispenza, his work, You Are the Placebo, and we'll take your calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. We'll take your phone calls. Dr. Joe Dispenza with us. Joe, when you were putting together the book, You Are the Placebo, anything surprising for you?
Well, one of the things that we did after a period of time, we were doing several workshops around the world, and one of the things that we noticed was that a lot of people were experiencing remissions right during our events in real time. We were seeing people with MS that were paralyzed, standing up and walking, and we started realizing that these people were signaling genes. They were upregulating genes for health, and they were downregulating the genes for their disease. And so we assembled a team of scientists. I brought in a team of neuroscientists and technicians. We brought in a physicist, and we brought in, different biologists and researchers. And I wanted to really measure what was going on in people in our events. And so we started doing these advanced workshops that were four and a half days long. And a certain percentage of people had their brain scanned with a quantitative electroencephalographic reading before the event. And then after four and a half days, they got their brain scanned after the event. We randomly selected several people, and during any process that we were doing, we began to measure their brain to see what was happening in real time right during the event. We were also measuring the amount of energy in the room. In other words, was the energy moving up in the room? We had sophisticated devices to measure the energy fields around people's bodies, the energy centers of their bodies. We even measured their heart coherence in reference to their brain coherence. Some people wore heart rate variability monitors, and all of this information is for us to be able to quantify exactly what's happening in people's brains and bodies. We even did epigenetic testing in our last event to see if people were able to make changes in real time.
Could they, by the way?
Oh, yeah. We made scientific history in the last year, without a doubt. I mean, we have people in our audience that turned Parkinson's disease around, that healed themselves of traumatic brain injuries.
Jeez.
Saw the pre and post scans. And the scans are in the new book. They're in You Are the Placebo. We brought in a bunch of colored scans because I want people to see how powerful they really are. People that were healing themselves of uterine fibroids that were bleeding, 2 liters of blood every menstruation. We talk about...
Well, were they doing it, Joe, or were they coached to be able to do it? I mean, can someone just start healing on their own, or do they need someone like you to be there to kind of push them?
I think knowledge is the precursor to experience, George. And the more knowledge we have, the more prepared we are for an experience. And when people begin to understand that new emotions can begin to signal new genes in new ways, they assign more meaning behind what they're doing. And one of the elements that allows the placebo response to work really well is by assigning meaning to what we're doing. The more you know what you're doing, the better results you can have. So we take people and we ask them to retreat from their life for 4 days or 4.5 days to begin to remove the constant stimulation from their external environment that reminds them of who they think they are, to no longer go to the same place, see the same people, do the same thing, and begin to separate themselves from their known familiar life long enough to learn new information, new science of what's possible. And then learning is making new synaptic connections, but if you can repeat it, then you begin to wire that information in your brain. Now, so then the information then learned, and then if they're able to repeat it, they're beginning to establish networks of neurons that reflect a new mind. Now, if we can give them the proper instruction on what to do, and they can get their behaviors to match their intentions, well, then they should experience some type of transformation. Now, if we could measure that transformation and interpret what we measured, that's more information to teach transformation. If we could measure that transformation, now we have even more information to teach transformation, and we can close the gap between knowledge and experience. So we do teach people how to do it, and people have done it in history for hundreds and hundreds of years, and we've all done something amazing in our life. But what we're asking people to do is to make it a skill. And for example, the average person usually takes about 1.5 to 2 minutes to change their brainwave states.
That's not long.
Yeah, not too long, but our students can do it in less than a minute. Some can do it in 4 or 5 or 9 seconds. Now, that's not like a competition, but it means it's a skill, so they can get beyond their analytical mind to begin to enter that autonomic nervous system. And I now know without a doubt that you and I are at our best when we get beyond ourselves. I also know that it requires more than just the brain changing the brain. It's not matter changing matter. It's not the ego changing the ego. It's not the program changing the program. That when you begin to analyze your life within a specific stress emotion or analyze your life within a past emotion, you actually drive your brain further out of balance. But when a person truly becomes, gets beyond themselves, and they become nobody, no one, no thing, nowhere, in no time, they become pure consciousness. They become thought alone. In other words, if you're going to heal yourself by thought alone, you have to become thought alone, and you have to disconnect from your known association to the things and people in your life, to begin to disconnect from your body and your pain and your face and your gender and your profession, and you got to really forget about time, and that's a skill. And we saw when people do that, when they get to that point over and over again, we've seen over 500 brain scans, that people's brains get highly organized, highly coherent. And when your brain's coherent, you're coherent. And when your brain's working well, you're working well. So when that occurs, at the exact same time, we see a certain amount of coherence that takes place in the heart, and the elevated emotions of appreciation and gratitude and inspiration produce very significant rhythmic changes in the heart, and the magnetic field of the body begins to enhance. Now, that quality then is something that we can learn to develop as well, because when you marry a clear intention with that elevated emotion, you're literally having an effect on matter. So we measure the energy in the room, and boy, after 3 or 4 days, the energy in the room was significantly higher. We measure the energy field around people's bodies, and we now know that when you free yourself from the chains of certain emotions, that the body goes from particle to wave, from matter to energy, and there's a release of energy, and we start feeling happier and lighter.
Joe, let's spend the rest of the hour taking some calls with you. We'll go to Las Vegas to get things started. Jody's with us on the wild card line. Hey, Jody, thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm glad I got through. My question is, can somebody else manifest something in your life, whether on purpose or subconsciously, if they want something bad enough or believe or jealousy, whatever, a positive or negative, is that possible?
Well, are you asking me if someone can influence somebody else's reality, or can they create something for themselves?
Yeah, basically someone else's reality, like a breakup in a good relationship, for basic example.
In other words, can you influence a person to return back to a relationship?
Well, to be specific, I think my mother just, even though she liked my boyfriend, now my husband, I don't know if it was sort of a subconscious, like a jealousy. She's more money oriented. And I said, you know, I would much rather be with a man that takes care of me, where we, you know, have to struggle for our money, than be with a rich guy that, you know, treats me like crap. And, you know, I think she's always been, my husband's a hard worker, and we had something really good going. And she always has said, well, he's not meant for you. And just some weird issues that should not be a problem have been wreaking havoc in our lives. And at least before I had thought that way, I was wondering if that could be affecting it. I mean, I think now that I'm conscious of that, even being an idea, I don't think, I'm trying to manifest different ideas just on my own, but I was wondering if that might be a possibility, if someone else could want something bad enough.
Let's answer it on two levels. First of all, the first level we answer it on is that it's really difficult to influence a closed mind. That's one of the most impossible things in the universe, is to change a closed mind. That being said, when you begin to generate more authentic emotions like compassion and empathy, when you begin to have more kindness and forgiveness, that creates a space of possibility for people to show up differently. So the best advice I could give you from just the highest standpoint is to really resolve it in a place of love. And if you're happy even though she's unhappy, and you don't have any guilt, you don't have any energy, you don't have any sadness because she doesn't accept your husband, the more you find and embrace a greater state of being, the more you open the door for her to show up differently.
There's no question about it. Joe, when you started doing this, where do you go next with it? Because you've learned so much with it.
Well, I mean, we're always interested in pushing the envelope. I know the limits of the placebo effect according to scientific studies. But if you think about it, if you see someone dance the salsa well, you'll dance the salsa better. If you see someone hit a tennis ball like Serena Williams, you'll hit a tennis ball better. If you see someone lead with compassion in your life, you'll lead with compassion better. And if you see someone stand up and talk about how they turned the disease around and it took them a year to do it and all the things they had to overcome to do it, or you read about someone who's done it, you're more prone to accept it's possible for you. So we're only as good as our students that are doing the work, and we're only as good as the people who are actually creating the change. But I'd like to push the limits of what's possible and begin to see, like, some of the genetic conditions turn around and publish this so that people really get to understand how they could apply it to their lives.
JJ is in Camp Creek, South Carolina. Thanks for calling, JJ, and you're on with us. Go ahead.
Well, I have kind of a few little questions. First, I want to ask about the book. Is it meant for the general public to read? Like, is it kind of an instructional, like a how-to accomplish these things, or is it more of like a statistical medical analysis?
Oh, God, I wouldn't bore you with statistical medical analysis. The book, I wrote it in a way that anybody could understand, that I tell really great stories of, you know, for example, a guy that was diagnosed with cancer and was given a certain amount of time to live. And, you know, he dies almost to the day, and then they would do an autopsy on his body, and they find out that he had never had cancer, that he died by thought alone. I tell stories to inspire you to realize how powerful we are as human beings. And then I give a very simple understanding of the history, and I talk about the simple science of how the placebo works, and I've made it so that everybody could understand it. I take you through a little bit of a journey to understand what beliefs and perceptions are and how they're formed. And then the second half of the book, JJ, is really about how do you begin to apply these principles so that you can begin to measure the effects of you at cause. And what we found out is that this is a time in history where people just don't want to know. This is a time in history where they want to know how. So it's simple enough for the average person to understand. It's simple enough for you to get the understanding of how to apply it to yourself. And there's a certain second half of the book. There'll be meditations that you can download that you can begin to practice. And we know they work because we've seen them work many, many times
Great.
In our workshops.
Yeah, my second question to you is, have you seen any success cases with people using your technique to overcome addictions, like maybe alcohol or drugs, or maybe if they're coming off of a certain drug, using that mind-changing technique to maybe overcome withdrawal symptoms or any? How does it work with addictive behaviors? Take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, JJ, we've seen so many people overcome addictions, both with alcohol and drugs, and even other things like pornography and gambling and shopping. We've seen a lot of change. Now, let's talk about that, because for most addicts, they have some emotion that they don't know how to change. And that emotion has been an event that's created from some event or series of events that happened in their past. And that event produced an emotional reaction that lingered for years on end. And for the most part, they're really locked into the past because emotions are a record of the past. So if they can't think greater than how they're feeling, then for the most part they're thinking in the past and they can't get beyond themselves. So the only thing that they do is they look for something outside of them to change that emptiness that's happening inside of them. And when they can do something, take something that makes that feeling go away, the moment they notice the change in their internal state, they pay attention to whatever, whoever caused it outside of them. And that association then begins to create a dependency on something outside of us. And so the problem with that is that the next time we use a drug, the next time we drink alcohol, we need a little bit more because the receptor sites on the cells become desensitized to the substance or even to gambling or to the or computer gaming, because the rush of chemistry begins to desensitize their very receptor sites, and so it requires more to turn them on the next time. It's like living with a spouse that always yells at you. They have to yell a little bit louder to get your attention. Well, receptor sites are the same way. So over time, the receptor sites begin to become recalibrated to a higher and higher level, so we require more to get them to turn on, and that's called an addiction. So then we could say that behind every single addiction, there's an emotion that's causing the person to use. And so when we begin to teach people how to lower the volume to that emotion, or what we call unmemorize that emotion, and the body's no longer limited because it's living in the past, and it's truly freed from the chains of the past emotionally, that's the person can finally relax into the present moment, and they no longer have a need to use because they've taken care of the emotion that they've been trying to change out inside of them. And so we've been hypnotized and conditioned into believing that change has to happen outside of us. You know, buy the new sports car, go on a vacation to a new place, buy a new boat, go to a new social club and meet new people. It's all about regulating some change by your external environment. Well, there comes a point where sooner or later, we have to look within. And when people begin to look within and they begin to overcome those emotions within them, the side effect of that is called joy. And when you find that place of wholeness, we saw over and over again, and I'm not kidding you, so many times when people have healed themselves or changed and transformed some past condition, they reach a level of wholeness where they feel so happy with themselves and so satisfied with who they are that they no longer care if they have the disease, and that's when it literally disappears. So that process of change then has nothing to do with anything outside of us. It has to do with changing our internal states. And we saw this when I was in the movie What the Bleep, and we saw one of the things about the feedback what we got from the movie What the Bleep was that we saw so many people that had addiction problems begin to become aware that they were addicted to some emotion, and they didn't know how to change it, so they had to use something else to try to change that state. Well, now that when people begin to execute the how-tos and they begin to regulate their internal states without anything outside of them, wow, all of a sudden they're no longer dependent on anything outside of them, and that's called true healing.
Joe, we're going to come back with you in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take some final phone calls, so don't touch your dial. Oh, you've got to take a look at our television program, Beyond Belief. It's really something that's taking the internet by storm. You know, you can just hook it up to your television. You get it through all those different kinds of systems. You can look at it for 10 days free. It's Beyond Belief. And how do you get to it? Well, you do this. Just go to this website, www.beyondbelief.com. Simple as that. Welcome back. Joe Dispenza with us. Joe, the book, of course, You Are the Placebo. It's out, available all over the place.
Yeah, I think the most common way that people can get it is on Amazon, but it's in Barnes & Noble. We have it on our website. But I think most people order it on Amazon. And it was released today. Today is the, yesterday, I guess, at this point.
Well, the timing's still good. Let's go to Cheryl in Huntington Beach. Hello, Cheryl. You're on with us. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, Mr. Norrie, and enjoy your show always.
Thank you so much.
And my question is, do you think that the children have more healing powers than adults? My question is only that because when I was a child, I broke my arm, and I went to a specialist in Boston. He said, well, you know, it's this or that. It's a growing bone. And I was supposed to have a 5-year-old bone, and now I'm 50-something, and my arm grew back. Of course it did, but it's not as strong as it used to be. So that was my question. Do you think children have more powers mentally than adults as far as healing powers go? Thank you.
I think it's easier for children to make substantial changes. For two reasons. Number one, for children when they're born, for the first 2 years of their life, their brainwave patterns are in delta. In other words, they're asleep with their eyes open. That's why a newborn baby can't stay awake for more than a few minutes at a time. From the ages of 2 to 6, the brainwave patterns move into theta, and theta is kind of that twilight state. So from 0 to 6 years old, the first 6 years of a child's life, they're pretty much completely in their subconscious mind. And all information that comes in unencoded without any analytical facilities, and most of their attention is on their internal environment and their internal chemistry. So when they notice pain or they notice pleasure, they begin to respond by putting their attention on their external environment, and that's how they begin to develop habits and behaviors. From the age of 6 to 12, the brainwave patterns move into alpha, and that's the imaginary world. And that's why you can tell a little girl to act like a rabbit at 8 years old, and at 6 in the morning you can tell her that, and it's, 5 in the evening and she's still a rabbit, because that imaginary world is very real to children. So because alpha and theta and delta represent pretty much the door into the subconscious, then you can really help children really make significant changes and begin to program them to heal more effectively. And by the same means, when they're faced with trauma, when they're faced with abuse, it's those strong emotions that begin to program in them in a detrimental way, because they begin to confuse, say, love with a caregiver with abuse, and that's when they get in trouble. So children tend to be more open to suggestions because they have a very open door to the subconscious. So we can program children to heal because they are very close to their autonomic nervous system. The second reason is that children don't have as much baggage emotionally. They come pretty much fresh and clean, and they take information pretty readily. And adults tend to have a little bit more baggage, a little bit more identity, a little more personality, a little more rigidity. Children are way more neuroplastic and way more flexible. They're using both sides of their brain way more than adults do. So the adults, it takes a little bit more effort, and we always joke around in our workshops because the parents are always worried about the children not getting it, and we're more concerned about the parents, not the children. Children get it pretty immediately. So children have an innate ability to heal a lot faster because they're closer to their autonomic nervous system.
Do some people have brains that allow them to do this, heal a little better than others?
Well, it's not the brain, although the brain is one of the elements of it. What we know now is that a person who has the highest level of suggestibility, suggestible to a thought, that person has the least amount of analytical facilities. The person who has the most analytical facilities has a very strong analytical mind, is less prone to suggestibility. So there's nothing wrong with the analytical mind. The analytical mind is healthy. It allows us to discern right from wrong, prepare us for a future based on a past. It allows us to really weigh what we know against what we don't know. So the analytical mind works well for us, but it gets in the way when we get out of balance emotionally, when the stress hormones begin to become activated, then we get overly analytical and we tend to analyze everything within the emotion that we're experiencing. And so it's not the brain, George, that does that. It's really a function of our analytical mind. And you can have a strong analytical mind. I mean, I do. But one of the things that we have to learn how to do is get beyond it. And getting beyond it then really allows us to really make some substantial changes.
All right, we've got more callers. We go to Derek in Toronto on the international line. Derek, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Norrie and Mr. Dispenza. I was just listening tonight about this placebo thing, and it reminded me of the stories of the unicorn in starting from the Dark Ages, where the alicorn was used as a remedy to a lot of unexplained diseases back then, and alchemists were using shards of alicorn, the unicorn's horn, and propagating a lie about a unicorn, period, they used the horns to treat people, and it was really used for rich people at those times, and it had some results, obviously, because it sort parallel with today's knowledge of placebo, that there's some, you know, the mind, can, you know, you can trick the mind into healing the body, kind of. And just wondering whether you have any anything to add to whether, you know, whether there's any parallels between placebo and the story of the unicorn.
Well, it could be allegory and it could be true, but the physiology is exactly the same. When you put high value on something and people want it more, the more that they want it, the more that they feel like they need it, the better results they get from it. And if you assign meaning, as I said earlier, to whatever it is, and say, for example, the doctor's enthusiastic about a new medication, but it's really a placebo, and the doctor has a certain amount of command, that enhances the effects of the placebo. So the placebo has a mystique to it because it's set up on conditioning or conditions. And so by assigning meaning to something like the unicorn horn, whether it's a fable or truth, it's the fact that the person really accepts, believes, and surrenders that it could heal them. And it's that particular process that really makes the difference. So here's an example. They took a group of maids that were working in the south of the United States, and the group of researchers came along and they studied these maids' actions, and they found out that when they watched the maids pushing furniture around in the day in hotels and flipping mattresses and scrubbing, you know, tiles in the bathroom and pushing carts and doing all pushing vacuums, the researchers realized that the maids were exceeding the Surgeon General's requirement for exercise. Now, they divided the maids into two categories. In one category, they let the maids continue doing what they were doing. But in the second category, they sat down with the maids and they said, look, you know, you're actually burning more calories than you're consuming. And, you know, exercise is good for your heart. It lowers your heart rate. And it's good for reducing body fat, and it can help you lose weight. And, you know, they went through all the benefits of exercise. Now, the moment the maids began to assign meaning to what they were doing, they never did anything differently. They continued doing the same exact job, but after a month later, they lost weight, they had less body fat index, their heart rate went down by 10 points, and they had greater self-esteem. So when we understand, when we assign meaning to what we're doing, we gain greater value. So all the lore and the mysticism that goes along with anything, and if it's wanted really badly or if it has a high value, then we put more intention, more meaning behind it, we get greater results.
Okay, we've got more calls for you. Jeremy is in Yakima, Washington. Well, that's obviously west. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Hi, George. A huge fan, long-time listener.
Thank you.
Great program tonight. I'm loving everything I'm hearing. Two things real quick. Quick story about the mind. I've always been a firm believer of, you know, it's all in your mind. If you want to be happy, you'll be happy. If you want to be sad, you'll be sad. When I was growing up, I had ADHD. When I was a kid, from the time I was about 8 years old till I was 18, they had me on all types of medications. And it made me overweight, and I didn't get along with people. And then when I turned 18, I decided I don't want to take these no more. And ever since then, I've been great functioning in society, and I don't have any problems. I'm back at a healthy weight. And then I'm a firm believer of, you know, get off the pills and, you know, just, you know, I don't know, deal with it, I guess. And then, you know, I'm a Christian, so that kind of helps me, too. And also, just one quick question. The placebo thing. Like, now, what if you give somebody an antibiotic and tell them it's a placebo? Will the body, and, like, you don't tell them it's a placebo, will the body think or not react to the antibiotic? And I'll take my answer off. Thanks.
Okay. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, not everybody responds to the placebo the same way. So if you give a person an antibiotic and you tell them it's a placebo, that person may have a reduced effect because there's an element called the nocebo. And the nocebo means that certain people develop these side effects from an inert substance. And so a person who then is given an actual drug, it can lessen the efficacy of the drug. But there's been studies with irritable bowel syndrome where they have taken people with significant symptoms from an irritable bowel syndrome and they have given them the placebo and told them, we're giving you the placebo, and it's an inert substance, and a high percentage of those people had a significant reduction in their symptoms, even though they knew they took the placebo. So it's kind of a funny phenomenon, but and a certain percentage of people, it can lessen the efficacy, but in another percentage of people, it may have no effects at all. But what I do want to comment about is your decision about your ADHD or your ADD, because when people begin to make a decision with firm intention that they are going to change, and they make a decision that they, no more am I going to live with this condition, so many people, when they do that, when they make that decision with such firm intention, and the amplitude of that decision carries a level of energy that's greater than the hardwired programs in their brain and the emotional conditioning or addiction in their body, and their body begins to respond to their mind. In other words, the choice that they're making becomes a decision that they never forget, and it's that kind of decision that begins to rewrite the program. It's no different than the snake handler in the deep south in a state of absolute faith can get bit by a poisonous snake and have no blood coagulation. He's in a state of absolute certainty. He doesn't say that morning, geez, I hope I don't die today. Or the mother whose daughter is trapped under a car, the mother doesn't run up to the car and say, gosh, I ate carbohydrates today and I didn't work out in 2 weeks. No, they don't do that. It's a decision that has a certain level of energy, a certain level of intensity, and it is that level of energy then that begins to change the body, and that's when we begin to rewrite the program, and that is what it takes to change a belief about anything.
We've got a few more minutes left here, Joseph, so let's take a few more calls. Let's go to David in Florida on the wild card line. Hey, David, thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, guys, I was wondering if going to a hypnotherapist could enhance the placebo effect.
Great question. The hypnosis is the exact model that we use for meditation because hypnosis is the same process. It's a disorganization of the inhibitory processes of the brain. You're going to get beyond the conscious mind, get past the analytical mind, and you're going to enter into the operating system. And certain people under hypnosis accept suggestions very well. I talk about in the book a story of a man that was a law-abiding citizen that went through a series of tests to test his suggestibility. And as he began to pass each test, he was able to do exactly what the researcher said. And finally, they put him in a bucket, a huge bath of ice. And they tell him that the ice water is really warm. Now, all the other people are beginning to become siphoned out of the study because their suggestibility isn't sustained. But this one guy moves to such a level of internal order that the external environment has no effect on him. Now, that's a high level of suggestibility that most of us don't have. And so they program him to commit a murder, but it's really not a murder. It's a staged murder, and he doesn't even know that he did it. And so that kind of suggestibility demonstrates that we all have our own levels, and hypnosis is a way to get into deeper levels of the subconscious and really begin to affect habits and behaviors.
Truly amazing. It is how it all works. Let's go to Gary, Charlotte, North Carolina. Get you in here real fast. Go ahead, Gary.
Yes. This is from the last hour. There was a doctor. There was a question asked about a doctor that had a cure for cancer in Texas. Do you have the doctor's name?
His last name, I'm not going to say he cures cancer, but his last name is Brzezinski.
Could you spell it?
I can't spell it, but if you go online, just put in Dr. Brzezinski, Brzinski. Google will correct that spelling for you. And he's down in Texas.
In what part?
Down by the Dallas area, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
bye.
You're welcome. Absolutely. Okay, Joseph, we're almost out of time. I'd like you to give out your website.
And sure, my website.
All your books.
Website is drjoedispenza.com, drjoedispenza.com, and on there, in there is just a lot of information about the workshops we do and a lot of online courses and stuff. My latest book, You Are the Placebo, Making Your Mind Matter, is really what we've been talking about today, how you can change your health by thought alone. My book before that, the last one we talked about on your show about a year and a half ago, was is called Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself, How to Lose Your Mind and Create a New One. And it is also the how-to book on personal change and personal transformation. My first book was called Evolve Your Brain, The Science of Changing Your Mind. And it is really the neuroscience of spontaneous remissions from disease.
Super. Joe, thank you for being on the program. Truly appreciate it. Dr. Joseph Dispenza. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.